Welcome to The Real Deal. This is 90.9 FM WDCB. I'm Orbert Davis, and I am extremely excited. The man you're listening to right now, Terrell Stafford. And see, the problem is going to be is that he and I talk so much, we've talked about so much recently, and in the past, we've known each other for a while, that we may start having a little personal conversation, so you have to forgive us for that. So welcome to The Real Deal, Terrell.
Thanks, great to be here, Orbert.
All right, man, where do we start? You know, I want to start because I always talk to you about balance, you know, especially balancing your career with the real world. And for our listeners, you've heard him on this very show, his music, especially from your last CD. But you are everywhere at the same time, it seems. How do you do it?
No sleep.
That's not good.
No, it's not good. But, you know, it's funny because, I mean, you know, I mean, when you have a passion for playing, and when you have a passion for creating, and you have a passion for people, you know, the person that gets sacrificed the most is yourself.
Oh, man.
And you're always giving and giving and giving and giving. And you get back, of course. That's why we keep doing what we do.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just can't stop. The word no seems like it doesn't exist in my vocabulary.
Oh, man. Well, tell us just a little bit of your history of who you've played with and how it all started.
Well, it's really interesting. The first person that I ran into when things started was Bobby Watson. I was in grad school, completing my degree in classical trumpet. And when I auditioned for grad school, I auditioned for jazz and classical, and I got rejected from the jazz program.
But oh, no.
I got accepted to the classical program. So I said, you know,
I'll
pursue my master's in classical trumpet. And things were fine until I started to hear people around me practicing jazz. I said, man, so who did you learn that from? Where did you get that from? They say, you should go talk to Professor Barron. So I run up and talk to Professor Barron. He gave me some tips. And he told me one day, he goes, you know, you can sit in this practice room and you can practice all the jazz you want. But until you get out in the public eye and you're out doing jam sessions and just getting your butt kicked, you're not going to learn anything.
Check that out.
So I went to my trumpet teacher. His name was Professor William Fielder, and went and recommended him to me. And he was a great trumpet player. He played both classical and jazz. So I said to Prof, we called him Prof, I said, man, I want to learn how to play jazz. He goes, you know what? You don't play the trumpet well enough.
Oh,
he
man.
Goes, you still get tired playing the Brandenburg. And I was like, who don't get tired playing the Brandenburg?
Right.
So I said, okay. And he goes, and if I hear from anyone that you are playing jazz, I will drop you as a student.
Oh,
and he was the only trumpet instructor,
oh,
you know,
right.
at Rutgers. So,
yeah.
So as it goes, I contacted another person who just sent me a text message. His name is Paul Carr, and I called him, and he lives in D.C. area. And I said, do you know of any jam sessions that I could come down and play? You know, and he goes, why did you come down here? You're up in New Jersey. Play something there. I said, no, I can't let anybody know I'm playing jazz. So this dude says, yeah, I'm starting one at this club called Tacoma Station. Come on down.
All right.
So I went down every Tuesday night, had my trumpet lessons on Mondays. Tuesdays I zipped down to Tacoma Station. Wednesdays I had to get back to school because I had orchestra.
Oh,
and I couldn't tell anyone. So I go down and play this jam session. Paul would teach me stuff, and other people would come in the session and say, man, you should learn this tune. You should learn this tune. I write it all down. And I could never practice it at school. So, I practice it away from school so nobody knew, you know. Because I still wanted to study with Prof. And lo and behold, one night, this alto player came into the club, and he was destroying everything he played. So I went up to him. I said, man, you sound incredible. My name's Terrell Stafford. And he said, you sound great. He goes, I'm playing with McCoy Tyner this weekend. You want to come check it out? I said, sure. And I went, and he gave me some music. He goes, I want you to come to New York and play this music, play some of this music. And I've been playing jazz maybe 3 months.
Is that right?
Yeah. I just started. And he goes, come up to New York. And I read stuff through. And he had me do a couple gigs in New York, which were disastrous.
I find that hard to imagine.
Oh, trust me.
No, but no, that's when I met you and I first heard you, when you came to Chicago with Bobby. So, no, you were a master then.
Come on. It's funny because Bobby was kind of making fun of me last night, and I did a record session last week with this pianist, Joey Calderazzo. And the very, very first jazz gig I did with Bobby was with Victor Lewis, Christian McBride, Joey Calderazzo. And, you know, so I show up and I'm like, these guys are kind of young. I'm not going to be the worst one on this gig. Victor Lewis, he's older. He's going to be killing, but these other two,
kids,
I got them. the bass player looks like a little, you know, middle school kid. So Bobby counts off this fast song, and so on this fast song, Joey starts to play, and I was like, okay, maybe he's not a kid. He must be a ringer. But the bass player is never going to be able to play this tempo.
Okay, what song was that?
I think it was like Country Cornflakes.
Country Cornflakes?
Yeah. And Bobby recorded this song with Roy Hargrove, and that's when I first heard Roy Hargrove. But anyway, it's burning, you know, and we started to play that and got to the bass solo. I was like, he can't hang.
Oh.
Christian McBride tore that.
This is during the session.
This was during, we were playing at this club in New Jersey.
Okay, okay.
And this club, ironically, was called Struggles. Lord have mercy, I was struggling that night. And I was like, the piano player can play, the bass player can play. I am the weakest one. Oh no. Goodness. So cotton mouth after everything that happened, I left. I refused to get paid by Bobby. I said, no, you keep it. Wow. Got on the train. I went back to Pennsylvania. I was like, this isn't for me. I'm going to continue with my orchestral preparations and go into classical music.
My goodness. Well, let's hear a little bit of Country Cornflake. This is Bobby Watson.
Bobby Watson and Roy Hargrove. This was Roy's introduction to the world.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that was Country Cornflakes. I could use some of that right now.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we're talking about with my guest, Terrell Stafford, is this aspect of being a classical musician and a jazz musician. And do you consider yourself a classical musician, or does it make a difference anymore?
I don't think it makes a difference. When I first got out of grad school and I moved to the Philadelphia area to teach at Temple, I did get a lot of calls to do a lot of classical trumpet. And I did quite a bit of work with some of the guys in the Philadelphia Orchestra. That's nice. How I met them. And, you know, time goes on. My security as far as playing classical music started to diminish just because I didn't practice it enough.
That's it. Yeah.
And so now I'm extremely insecure. I mean, I still practice it now just to maintain.
Yeah.
But to play it in public is not something that I dream about doing.
I know what you mean.
Yeah. And so I you know, a few years ago, part of my tenure at Temple University, I had to play this concerto with the orchestra. And I played one a couple years ago, but it was both classical and jazz, so I was fine. But this one was 100% classical.
Right.
And just, I never forget, the week before, I couldn't eat, I couldn't sleep. And I was playing the concerto for a lot of different people, and I was probably practicing at least the whole thing at least maybe 4 or 5 times a day.
Wow.
You know, just a schedule, just to make sure my endurance and everything was there, you know, my focus and concentration. And then it got to the performance, and I looked in the front row and saw some of the guys from the orchestra, and I just... It was like, why am I doing this? This is your job, not mine.
Oh, wow.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You get paid to play classical music. I don't.
Security has a lot to do with
oh,
it.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And then the little bugs get in your head and forget it.
Forget it.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
But at this point, I mean, you know, you can look back on your classical career and say, you know, bye-bye.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how I like to look at it. You know, my parents are like, well, you should resurrect one of those concertos you played. I said, I think somebody who does it all the time should do it. And they can put my name on the record if they want.
Or, you know, you can just play it for them.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. In the living room.
There you go.
Living room concert.
There you go. Wow. In terms of, we're talking about balance and balancing classical jazz, balancing schedule, you say lack of sleep.
Mm-hmm.
How do you balance teaching with performing?
You know, I never thought I would say this, but truly they go hand in hand for me.
Right.
I remember my undergraduate degree was from University of Maryland. It was in education, music education.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, that's the only way my parents really would let me go to school and study music. Because they were like, you know, your trumpet playing is, you know, you're not really good enough to make it in the world of music. So
not many spots should, opening in the orchestra.
That's right.
A big one.
And, You know, you practice a lot, but you should become a teacher. Because if you really can't make it playing, you can always teach.
Right.
And something about that phrase has always bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because honestly, do you really want someone who has just failed as a player to now teach?
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I didn't want that. I didn't want to represent the teaching world as a failed performer.
Exactly.
And so when I got in college, everybody around me had this mentality. So, you know, the people who had performance degree or getting a performance degree would stay in the practice room hours.
That's
and
right.
All the ed people would be out doing other stuff.
Exactly.
Like, what?
Right.
Are you crazy?
Right.
So I was making it a point to practice just as much, if not longer, than all the performance
Excellent.
People. And so, you know, you get to be friends with them and you start to do gigs and they're like, you're an ed major. You know,
right.
You should be doing something ed-wise or reading a psychology book or something
right.
like that. So when I finished my degree, I was supposed to go into teaching, and I had a teaching job lined up. And then like 3 days before classes started, I called the superintendent. I was like, this is not what I want to do.
Wow.
I'm sorry.
Wow.
And my parents were just so paranoid about having a backup. I got a minor in computers, and I got a minor in math.
Very good.
So I tutored in trigonometry at University of Maryland, and then I was computer, they call it a programmer, but it was more of a troubleshooter at this insurance company.
Well, they call it geek. Actually.
Yeah, geek. That's right. They call it avoiding teaching. That's what it was. Duck in that teaching shelter. So that's what I did. And I did that for a while until I went to grad school. And then after grad school, I started to do the show with Mr. Cosby, Bill Cosby, Call You Bet Your Life. And he's the one that actually pushed me all the time. I was like, Stafford, are you doing any teaching? I was like, no, I just want to play. He goes, you should really think about teaching. And so
really?
This went on
really?
And on and on. And
that's good.
And he got me to consider it, Shirley Scott was the musical director for this show.
Awesome.
Yeah. And Shirley had an opening at Cheney University where she worked.
Oh, my goodness.
She goes, you can come right in and start teaching. It was like a survey of music course.
Mm-hmm.
So I took that gig, and that's how my teaching started.
Awesome. And that's great. That's good. One thing that I always tell students of jazz is that there really isn't a single career of being a jazz musician anymore.
It's not.
Actually, I use you as an example of someone who really doesn't have to teach because you're so busy performing and traveling. But many students say, I'm just going to play. I'm just going to play. When you look at the landscape of education at major universities all across the country, the heads of many universities, especially in jazz programs, are performing jazz musicians.
That's right.
So you have to have that passion for teaching. If not, it's just a photo opportunity or an ad in the magazine that says so-and-so teaches here.
And people know that. When they see those titles and they say so-and-so teaches there, you know, you always, there's some people that say, oh, and there are other people like,
yeah, just go to their website and say, okay, they're working.
That's right.
You know, that's difficult. How do you balance that?
When I was saying before, I mean, I think it goes hand in hand that, you know, just I just finished Monday night playing with, I did Frank West, it was his 90th birthday celebration, you know. And at the celebration, there were just so many jazz musicians that came down and just listening to the conversations and playing with most of them and listening to Frank and listening to Jimmy Heath and hanging out with Jimmy Heath. I mean, I can come back and say, you should have heard Jimmy Heath play whatever. What did he play? Without You Know Me. He wrote this chart for Dizzy called Without You Know Me. And it's a beautiful, the chord changes are beautiful, the melody's beautiful, the arrangement's great. Jimmy just, the way he approaches it is with so much patience. And then, you know, when Frank plays, Frank took, I would venture to say, on in a mellow tone, he probably took 8 choruses built into the arrangement. And it was fascinating just to hear how he, through themes, built each chorus until he got to the melody out. And, I mean, he blew the whole time except for a small shout section. Mm. And it's fascinating. You know, it's fascinating for me because it helps me to process, okay, now if you're going to take a solo, maybe you should develop these themes instead of just getting to it so quick, you know.
Exactly.
Have patience.
Right.
And so I can take that lesson from Frank and bring it back and say, okay, if we're working on this, show patience. Think about sound. Think about singing. Think about the lyrics. Think about, you know, melody. Think about, you know, everybody now is so focused on harmony, harmony, harmony. I got to play all this harmonic, you know. And if you talk to Mulgrew, who's like a harmonic genius, he goes, you know, harmony to me is melody. I just create melodies and have them in different keys, you know. So, you know, you start to talk to people and find out their philosophies. Like Mulgrew, I was like, Mulgrew, do you transcribe a lot? He goes, no, I never have. So there's some people who just have inherited this jazz vocabulary and can do it and can pass it along. And then there's other people who may not have that vehicle to pass it along, but they can do so just through playing, you know. So, you know, I mean, you're very articulate. I'm learning a lot just listening to you, and I learn a lot from you, so I can take what you've learned, bring that back to my trumpet studio and say, you couldn't have gotten it if I were just sitting behind these four walls.
That's right, yeah.
Couldn't have gotten it.
Yeah, and that's the value of the, you know, jazz itself is in the moment.
That's right.
It's real time. It's spontaneous, and that's the way the teaching has to be as well.
Absolutely.
If not, it becomes a classical model of teaching.
It does. And, you know, I think we were part of the discussion about, you know, the mentoring and, you know, having people come in and do workshops and clinics. For me, there's a few pet peeves, and one is, you know, there's certain teachers who teach in the moment, which is really important. But there are others that may bring a preconceived, you know, curriculum in their mind. This is what I'm going to work on.
Right.
The band or the group playing may have nothing to do with that preconceived or that pre-planned lesson plan.
Exactly.
But it's going to still be executed. And so, you know, I'm like, go for what you hear.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like improvising. You hear something.
Yeah,
it may work, it may not.
Yeah,
but you'll know next time. You know what to do.
I did a thing with our summer camp. We had about 150, mostly elementary students, and talking about improvisation. I had Ari Brown, tenor saxophone, and you know we're playing, and I had a piano solo going. And right before Ari put his horn up to play, I stopped and said, "What are you thinking about?" And he said, "Nothing." We did it again. Started playing, and he, about 1 second before he's ready to come in, I said, "What are you thinking about?" "Nothing."
Wow.
I said, that's jazz improvisation.
Yep.
Not thinking about, okay, I'm going to start with this, and I'm going to start, and then I'm going to play here.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is. It's
yep.
the moment.
Absolutely.
Well, it's time to feature you on something. What do you want to play?
You know, talking about the moment, and I'll just speak about this last Strayhorn record. A huge moment for me was to have John Clayton produce it because, I mean, you know, you don't really have to say much more, but, you know, his spirit and his knowledge and everything, it's just incredible. And we had worked the music out because we played on the road for a week, but we got to Lush Life and, you know, we played it. We played a take and John came in and he's like, you know, that was good, but is good really what you want? And he says, let's try this. Let's try this. Let's try this. Let's breathe more. Let's think this way. Let's just let everything that we feel go. Let's breathe it out. Let's try it again. Let's leave more space. And so when we came to it, we just were just like open and relaxed.
All right.
And we played it. And after we finished playing it, there was like no sound in the studio. We just kind of... And then it was over. You know, we kind of looked at each other. And then when I listened to it, I mean, I remember also, as trumpet players, we know, the thing you don't want to do is play the ballad at the end of the session. And that's what happened.
Oh,
so at
no.
the end of the session, you know, I'm like, oh, I had the quivers. I'm like, oh, no, the notes are going to go, you know, sound like a dog at the end when you know how you try to hold it. It's like,
ouch.
I did that on purpose.
Right.
So, you know, and it was like a few takes of it. So it's like, but when I hear it, I just think about what you just said about if you approach music with a clear mind, a clear spirit, a clear soul, then anything can happen.
All
and
right.
that's the spontaneity of it.
Well, let's do that. So everyone listen to this with a clear mind and a clear soul. Here's Terrence Stafford with Billy Strayhorn's Lush Life.
This is the real deal. I'm Terrell Stafford.
That was pretty good. That was pretty good. This is 90.9 FM WDCB. We got to talk about that. I am in the studio talking with Terrell Stafford about his career in music and teaching. A name came up just a second ago, and I want to talk about that name a little bit longer, and that's John Clayton. Mm. Terrell plays in John's quintet currently. Talk about John.
Wow. You know, I met John years ago. You know how you have those performances you do that you just feel awful about? I was playing with this pianist, Eric Reed, and Eric can be pretty tough. And so, you know, I was asking for charts ahead of time. No charts, no charts. Day of, get the charts.
Right.
So we're reading through all this stuff, and every time you get, you know, if you miss something, he's like, stop. Did I write that wrong? I said, no, that was my fault. That's my fault. Okay. Whoa. Did I write that wrong? I said, no, that's my fault. So, you know, each time this happens, like, you're like, your confidence is like,
oh, man.
So, and then he goes, okay, let's play some standards. And I said, well, which ones do you want to play? And he goes in his briefcase and he pulls out this list and puts it on the stand. And it was a list of standards. I didn't know one on the list. I was like, oh, my gosh.
I thought you said standards.
Yeah. Do we have a different interpretation of the word standard?
Right.
You know, so it's like one I recognized. I said, okay, let's do this. And I went back to the room and found a recording of it and, you know, went through it. So we get to the performance that night and we're playing through some of it. And everything was going all right. And, you know, you make that first mistake. Mm-hmm. As soon as you make it, you could feel him. I'm like, oh, no. So the whole time, you know, I'm just... my whole confidence is going down. And after it was over, I was so embarrassed. I started to look for the exit door in back of the stage. While everyone was out talking and congratulating, I packed up quicker than you could ever realize and went through the kitchen. I was gone, never to be seen again. I never came out of the room.
No.
Yeah. So I was like, man, nobody's going to see me. I'm not showing my face. So 2 days later, phone call came from John Clayton. And he says, I want to find out. I do this camp in Vail, Colorado, and I want you to come out and teach and play with the Clayton brothers. We've been doing quartet for years, and we're thinking about expanding it to quintet. And I said, nice. Sure. I said, have we met? He goes, oh, yeah. I met you briefly, and I heard you with Eric Reed. It was great. I was like, and you still call me? It's like, and it was funny because that week I came home from Chicago. I never forget, I had to stand outside for hours to wait for the shuttle.
Okay.
And so John didn't call me for 2 weeks. It wasn't 2 days, it was like 2 weeks. So I stand outside for the shuttle. It was freezing out. Uh-huh. I get pneumonia.
Oh, no.
So I come home, got pneumonia, sitting like, couldn't play. Oh, just like feeling man. Like had to cancel all these gigs. So two phone calls came in 2 weeks later. It was John Clayton, which kind of picked up my spirits.
Yeah.
And then 4 days later, McCoy Tyner called.
Oh.
And that was, I thought it was a joke. I thought, because Faddis likes to imitate people's voices.
Yeah.
So he calls me like, hey, how you doing? I'm like, who is this? My name is Billy. And, you know, he'll have this ridiculously silly voice. And I'll have this conversation with Billy, and he'll be like, so I want to learn how to play trumpet. Can you tell me, Mr. Stafford?
John
and sometimes I can get his voice, and sometimes I can't.
Yeah.
So I get this call, and it's like, hey, Dad, how you doing? Look at that. I want to know you guys. Yeah. I said, yeah, Faddis, funny. Click.
You didn't.
Yes, I did. Called back, and McCoy says, I speak to Terrell Stafford. I said, speaking. He goes, Terrell, it's McCoy Tyner. I'm sorry, I must have had a connection. I'm going to Japan in about a month, wondering if you want to come. And
oh,
I waited for
goodness.
A second. I said, Japan? Yeah. So it was McCoy, you know, and so that pneumonia period, I never forget. I was depressed, and then all of a sudden, two calls came in, like two and a half weeks later.
Wow. And you met McCoy back when Bobby was playing with him.
Yep.
Is that it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you know how you just don't know what to say to people when
right,
you meet them.
Course.
You know, it's like,
yeah.
Hi, McCoy. You know, so I said to him, I said, I'd love to play with you one day. You know, and he's like, oh, maybe you are. And I couldn't understand him. So I was like, man, I got to learn this jazz talk. I can't understand one word he said.
That's awesome. Hey, well, let's play something from the Clayton Brothers Quintet.
Mm.
Okay. Which is your favorite?
You know, the latest CD is called Song and Dance,
yes.
Which is really interesting.
Is
so pretty much anything off there.
So Chicago
Bop Steppin'.
Chicago Bop Steppin'.
Yeah, it's a really
perfect
cool one. Yeah.
Since we're in Chicago.
That's right.
All right. Here's Clayton Brothers Quintet with Chicago Bop Steppin' on The Real Deal with Orbert Davis, 90.9 FM, WDCB.
Thank you.
This is The Real Deal with Orbert Davis, and I'm sitting here with Terrell Stafford talking about all kind of stuff related to jazz and beyond. We talked a bit about the prankster. You know, he actually probably got his pranksterness from the great Dizzy Gillespie.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about John Faddis.
Oh, yeah.
One of the things that amazes me about John is the fact that he is a mentor.
Mm-hmm.
It's somehow, you know, because maybe it's because of his large frame, his height, that he tends to just hug everybody.
Yep.
And just embrace trumpet players. How much of an encouragement was John to you?
He was everything. I mean, you know, I met Bobby and I played with Bobby for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then was playing Bobby for a while and we did a couple records. And then Bobby's like, I want to do a big band record. And I didn't want to tell anybody. But since I really didn't play jazz that much, I played in the big band in college, but I wasn't. I just did it because they gave me $500 and I needed the money. And they needed bodies in the jazz band. There was no jazz program as an undergrad, and I wasn't in the jazz program as a master's student. So I'd never really played in a big band and knew what my real function was. I just played the part. So Bobby was like, I'm going to do a big band record. I was like, oh, my gosh. Oh, okay, great.
Right.
So
never say no, right?
Yeah, never say no. All so right. I said, who's going to play in the trumpet section? He goes, it's going to be Melton Mustafa, Ryan Kaiser, and John Faddis.
Oh,
I was like,
man.
John Faddis?
Right.
And I heard John. I was a huge fan. Never really met him, but I'd heard him before and seen him at different conferences and seen him at... So he walked into the room just killing, suede jacket on, in the cowboy boots, these boots to match. I was like, man, this dude is making some money.
Right.
You know, so we get in the section. And we played like the first chart, and Faddis, in front of everybody in the band, Faddis goes, Bobby, where did you get this jack leg trumpet player in my section from? And I was like, in my mind, I was like, wow, how could he talk like this about Melton? You know, Melton played with Count Basie. Ryan Carter plays in Lincoln Center. How's he going to do that? And so he started calling me Marlon Jordan.
Oh, no.
Because we looked alike. So he's like, he goes, Marlon, you're lucky to be in this section. He goes, all the great trumpet players in this town, and Bobby had to put you. You sound like every note is from the Haydn Trumpet Concerto.
Oh,
he tore me up. He just ripped me apart. And the whole day just yelling at me the whole time. Shorter,
right.
So we came out and we did the Chicago Fest with Bobby's band.
Mm-hmm.
And Faddis came out and we played there, and, you know, after the performance was over, Faddis was like, don't even look at me. You just mess up this whole section. You don't know how to be blend. You don't know how this. Your cutoffs are terrible. You know, your intro. So we were playing the Vanguard in New York, same band, and he was doing the same thing. And, you know, I'll take so much. Then after a little bit, I was like, okay. In my mind, I was like, if he says one more thing, I'm gone. Off. It's right in the middle of the song, and he said something to me. I said, look, beep, 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 on the air. So I said stuff to him that I would never say to another human being. And Ryan Kaiser was like, oh, boy. You know, so he was kind of ducking, and I just went crazy. And the audience was right there. And so Faddis was like, take it easy. We'll talk after the set. So then after the set, you know, we go in the back, and he's like, I was like, man, I said, you're probably the most jivest cat I've ever met. And, you know, you've been making fun of me for a whole year. And I've been putting up with it because I thought you were going to try to help me.
Uh-oh.
And, you know, I don't know if I can respect someone who's just going to continue to antagonize and not offer any help. He goes, if you want help, you need to ask. I said, well, help me. He goes, show up tomorrow at 3:00 at the Vanguard and I'll help you. The next day, I showed up at 2 to try to impress him. He was already sitting there reading the paper. So my impressing him didn't work because he beat me there. And then we got in the section. He stood in the trumpet section, and he took out a chart, and he said, he goes, okay, let's start playing this chart. And we start to play. He goes, no. Listen, put your ear in front of my bell. Listen to what I'm doing.
Yes.
He goes, listen to my articulation. Listen to my cutoff. Listen to how I swell. Listen to where I put vibrato. That's and right. he says, and then start to look at me from the corner of your eye. I'll give you what I want you to do.
Right.
And then we went through it. And he says, okay, now you see what to do. And he goes, now we have to get your attacks together because your attacks are too aw and not enough pa.
Right.
So then he went in the back of the Vanguard and he goes, I want you to play a high A, the top of staff.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, I want you to play 100 of them. And here's the sound I want. And he played it to me and I played it back. And he goes, yep, 100 of them. If you miss it, then you start back at 1.
That's right.
And I went through it. Pop, 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 pop. Oh.
Start over.
Pop, pop. And he was just reading the paper. And then, you know, after we made it through, we played the gig that night. And the whole band came. And Fattis was like, you know, when we get to the gig tonight, let's play like we're still angry.
Right. That's Fattis. Right.
So we got to the gig that night. And everybody's like looking. They see me come in. And they're like, hey, man, John's in the dressing room. You may not want to go back there. I said, I've been waiting all day. Wait till I was. So they were like, oh boy. So I go back and said, Fattis, I got more to say to you. And everybody runs out of the room. We're like laughing and stuff. So that's this kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah,
so
that too.
Anyway, after that opportunity with Bobby, he put me in the Carnegie Hall Jazz Band, and then he wrote a jazz opera. He and Dizzy was writing it. Dizzy passed. John finished it.
Right.
And I was the only trumpet player in this jazz opera. And it's like every time we rehearsed, he pulled me aside and he goes, I want you to be able to lead this section better. I want you to do this to lead the section. I want you to do this. I want you to cut off this way. I want you to use this. I want you to phrase it this way. Every day was a lesson from John Fattis. And then, you know, he's like, you got to work on your range. I got to get you doing it. And it's like, he's just so giving. And we go to the health food store every day and pick stuff out and talk. And we were in Charleston, South Carolina, or something like that, near a beach. Mm-hmm. Walk along the beach and just talk about life and music. It was the greatest time. And awesome. So now, you know, 2 days ago, he's really great about it. He calls you for every other week. Hey, just want to check in. Yeah. How you doing?
That's right.
It's an incredible man. So
very much.
My hat's off to him.
I remember one time I played with you. You were featured with the Chicago Jazz Ensemble.
Mm-hmm.
And I just did a concert night before with my group, and I was exhausted. So I had my girls with me. We in the back of the auditorium. I didn't want anybody to see me. I wasn't dressed. You know, just hanging to hear John and you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he had the last tune. He says, you know, we have a guest in our audience, and I want him to come down and play Terrell's flugelhorn.
Yep, I do.
That was great.
That was great.
Because Randy Brecker was on that. And
Tom
Harrell. Oh, my goodness.
And
the CJE trumpet section. So that was trumpet heaven.
Oof.
But John's like that. You know, he's like that. It's very, very cool.
Yeah.
So we're going to play John Fattis with Oscar Peterson.
Mm.
Things Ain't the Way They Used to Be.
Ah, beautiful.
All right, ready. Thank you. This is listener supported 90.9 FM WDCB, The Real Deal with Orbert Davis. And I have The Real Deal right here. It's The Real Deal with Terrell Stafford. Oh, man, I can't believe time has just flown by.
It really has.
Man. But this is a conversation that we have. We see each other maybe a couple times a year and kind of continue on. But I'm so glad that we're able to share just this wisdom with our listeners, too. Well, thank you so much, Terrell. This has
thank
been
you.
phenomenal for me. And our listeners as well. And we'll make this part one of
yes.
our session with Terrell Stafford on The Real Deal.
That's awesome.
Right
Thank
here
you.
On 90.9 FM WDCB. Thanks so much.
Thanks.